Hey, this is Wesley.
This is Jeremiah.
We're the Lumineers, and you're listening to Walking the Floor.
I'm walking the floor over you.
Walking the floor.
I'm walking the floor.
Walking the floor over you.
Hola, senores and senoritas. This is Chris Shiflett with another fine edition of Walking the Floor, coming to you live from my hotel room in London, England. It's summertime, so it's festival season. It's the, kind of the end of festival season. And of course, it's dreary and gray and rainy, and I will soon be in a muddy field somewhere. That I am sure of. But that's not going to stop me from having a good time today and being a good little tourist on my day off. Gonna get about to head out for a nice little walk around town and go, cruise some of my favorite haunts. All right. Hey, listen, if you have not got your tickets for my upcoming tour dates, starting at the end of August, running through the middle of September, the first one's up at Seven Peaks Festival up outside of Denver, and concludes at Americana Fest, doing a bunch of stuff out there. And if you have not gone to ChrisShiflettMusic.com yet and gotten your tickets, man, what are you waiting for? Get over there. There are tickets on sale, and all the ticket links are on my freaking website. So let's get to it, people. Let's buy some tickets. It's going to be a really fun tour. A couple of festivals thrown in there, a lot of club shows, and then, like I said, a bunch of stuff at Americana Fest. I don't know if that stuff's on sale. Or maybe you have to buy a ticket to Americana Fest. I don't know how that works. Don't look to me for answers, kids. It's all on the website. Okay, so you know my good friends over at Zounds.com. It's your one-stop shopping online for all your music gear needs. Did you know that they have free shipping on every order with no exceptions and no exclusions? Even crazy heavy items like tube amps, 8x10s, giant synth boards, subs, drum kits, all the hardware and larger format mixing consoles ship for free. Because Zounds has three warehouses strategically located across the United States to get you your gear faster than anyone else. So get on over to Zounds.com today and get your gear, kids. All right, let's get to today's interview. This week's interview with Wes and Jeremiah from the Lumineers was actually the very first interview I did in my new little studio office space. And I didn't realize when I rented it that it's right next to like a garbage truck depot run by the city. And it's a funky old building with like funky old windows that are, I've come to learn, not particularly soundproof. So don't be fooled. We are not standing on a street corner. We are inside, but garbage trucks drive by about every 5 seconds, and it sounds like they're about to run over us, but that was not the case. We had a grand old talk. These guys were really cool and a lot of fun to chat with, and I was thinking about it. You know, the Lumineers, when their first record took off, that happened to coincide with my kids being at the age where they were doing, like, piano recitals every 6 months or so, or, like, school band performances every now and again. And that's, like, how you can tell when a song really breaks through into the public consciousness, because at every one of those recitals, there'd be, like, one or two kids doing Ho-Hey. And that kind of success, I think, can kill a lesser band, or it can make you stronger. And I'd say clearly at this point, it made them a lot stronger because they've gone on to, you know, do a bunch of great stuff since then. And they're in the process right now of releasing a 3-part concept record at the moment. That if you haven't watched the video for Gloria, I highly recommend it. It's they've got this series of videos, one for every song on the record, and they are wonderfully twisted and dark and just so much darker than I expected to see from these guys. But I'm here to announce the Lumineers have a dark side, and we get into that right here. This is Wes and Jeremiah from the Lumineers on Walking the Floor. Gloria, no one said enough is enough.
I mean,
there's a lot I want to talk to you guys about, but the first thing that jumped out at me when I was getting ready for this, I want to start with those videos that you made for your new record. I mean, I know your new record's coming out in 3 installments.
Yeah.
We'll get into that, but those videos that you made, especially the one for Gloria, are so like wonderfully fucked up and dark and yeah. just not what I expected when I like clicked on YouTube to watch them. I would love to hear the sort of the story of how they came to be. I mean, especially like I said, that Gloria video when yeah. the baby is like tipping back the bottle of vodka. It's like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
It's so great.
Kevin,
was your record label like, guys?
Yeah, I don't think, I don't know if that was the ideal, you know, the way they were hoping for a video to advertise a song that they wanted to sell or something. But I think for us, we had hired Kevin. We saw this movie called Super Dark Times. We've each seen it and loved what he did with that movie. It was, if you haven't seen it, it's this sort of coming of age, kind of like how Stand By Me has this beauty to it, but it's dark, but it's way darker than that. And the characters he cast were so, it felt really real, like maybe they weren't actors, they were just being filmed mm-hmm. doing their natural thing. And so the album is about a lot of that that you see in the music videos. And so it was really nice to sort of bring the darkness, and there's a little bit of strange dark humor, like when the screen door is getting kicked out, it made us kind of like laugh. And Gloria, it happens a couple times, mm-hmm. it comes off the hinges. But yeah, I think the idea was, so many times, I'm sure you've experienced this, you'll write about something and someone will take one line out of the song and that means that's the song to them.
Right.
And it doesn't mean that that's wrong, but it was nice to say, hey, this is actually about some pretty dark shit. And I know it sounds upbeat, but it's about something that's been happening in my family, and I know Jer's experienced it in his own way. And so that part of it was really nice to sort of like paint a picture of without maybe hesitating or like, you know, photoshopping over it and saying like, no, this is actually what this is about. I know it might make you uncomfortable, but, and then the reaction was really interesting because a lot of people were actually like strangely comforted by that. Like the idea that you would like put it out there.
Right.
Because it's almost like we hide that part of our families. Like if there sure. is someone, it's like, well, maybe that reflects on me and I don't want you to know that then.
Yeah.
So I won't talk about this, but I'll like look over here. So it's been a very unexpected like kind of thing, because I thought it would just be kind of like maybe a disaster and then it would get better because people would start to like understand it and get with it as this slow burn thing.
I like that it struck me that it's so great that nowadays people don't make videos to get them played on MTV.
Right.
Because in those yeah. days you never could have made a video, yeah. you know, videos.
We'd
like that.
You'd have to have like a Vespa. And like,
right, you'd have to do some cutesy, very yeah. much like not a literal sort of a, you know, version of the song thing. That must have been kind of a I don't know, liberating.
Yeah, no, you're totally right. I was we were just in Florida somewhere rehearsing, and for this festival we were playing, and I was in this diner, and they had this like montage of all these '90s videos, and those were all the ones on loop on MTV, and I noticed this theme of like a group of people riding around on like a scooter or a Vespa singing the song, and it's just like yeah. a weird
bright colors
these. Yeah, and it's like
grainy black and white,
it's like Vegas on the screen or yeah. something. And yeah, it is. I think a lot of artists like kind of inspired that or said like, yeah, you can do this now because these aren't that's not their role anymore. They're actually like, it's the Wild West. You can kind of put anything you want out there and people decide what they like and where to find it. It's not so much dictated by this gatekeeper of
right.
of MTV.
Well, it's interesting though, because I feel like lots of people still sort of the gatekeepers of the industry came out of that time and are still kind of conditioned to sort of think that way. So I just thought it was kind of, I don't know, I imagine you guys like having to stand your ground to get those things done, because yeah. I could still just have to imagine management, record label, people like that are going
to
be,
we were
like,
just talking about that in the good. Car right over here. We had some time to reflect before meeting up with you, and I was saying like there's this confirmation bias, I think, that kind of plagues the record industry, like, well, this way worked, let's do that again, let's right. rinse and repeat.
Yeah.
And I get that, but I think times have changed, you know. We're making a bunch of videos for this album, and we're not really even in them. I mean, in the Glory video, I don't know if you caught this, you'd have to watch it 10 times to see me and Wes. We kind of play these EMT paramedics. We're probably in the music video for like 2 seconds, maybe.
Well, yeah. That was one of the compromises we made, actually. Yeah. They said, we need you in the videos. And we're like, okay. Asterisk, like you can barely find us.
Typically,
technically,
like,
we're in there.
Because the idea was to keep someone under a spell. Like, it was like, hey, I don't want you to remember that the band's in this. It's like a story being told. So, like, the minute you see the band member that you recognize, it can kind of, like, cold water on your face, shock you out of that, like, hypnosis you were put under with the, the visuals.
It, was I understanding correctly when I was watching that the album itself is sort of about a cast of characters that are all interrelated. It's like kind of like a concept record. But in the videos, was it the same? Was it intended to be like just the same handful of actors sort of playing all those characters, or were they supposed to be sort of moving through time?
You didn't get to meet the other two in those videos yet,
okay.
Or you kind of did.
Because when you're singing about your grandma or a grandma or whatever in one of the songs, it's still the same gal that's the wife and the, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's like, I hesitate making it so like formal, like, because it's not, it's supposed to be something that you almost make your own. When I
don't want
to
interpret it for anybody listening, but I'm just old and dumb.
It would make a lot more sense when we reveal the next couple of chapters.
Nice.
But essentially, chapter one is Gloria, and she's the mother of Jimmy Sparks, which is chapter three.
Okay. So you see baby Jimmy, you see a little, what do they call those things? Those that hang over a baby crib? I want to say panorama, but that's not it.
I know. I have three kids. I should really know this.
We each have a kid. We should know this too.
A mobile.
Yes.
Yes.
And it says Jimmy on it. And the director did put a lot of Easter eggs into the videos to try to help tell that story. And, you know, it's 1979. And it says Happy New Year's. And then it says when Donna, Gloria's mom, passes away on a headstone, and that's that same year. So it's this whole like story being woven, but there's no way you could really figure it out at this juncture exactly what's going on. You kind of have to just embrace that, oh, I'm learning more about like this part of this person in the story, and then later on there's these other parts that unfold. So in that way it's a concept, but in another way it's just like storytelling. That's all. It's just trying to tell a story.
I mean, from what I know about bands making videos and the process involved in that, how did you get Kevin Phillips, who's a movie director, to sign on to this whole thing? And how that must have been an amazing amount of work to make 10 video, or 9 videos. I assume you did them all.
Yeah, 10 actually. Yeah.
Oh, there's 10.
Yeah. So I mean, there's a track that's kind of like an instrumental. It almost gets us to the next track.
Okay.
Called April. But it was like our friend, so I was storyboarding this with Nick Bell. Shout out to Nick Bell if he ever listens to this, because he did such amazing work on this. And we were trying to figure out, okay, we have like Jimmy Sparks and we have Gloria Sparks, and then we figured out this junior character in the middle of all that. And we storyboarded that like you would a music video, you know, and I don't know if you've ever done that where you sit there and someone actually puts those, you know, sketches of, okay, here's what happens at 36 seconds to 39 or something like that. So we try to do that in a loose way for the whole, all the songs. And then he said, I know just the guy for this. And we had both worked with Kevin on a couple of our old videos, like Ophelia. He was the DP, the director of photography. So he had this really cool eye for things. And then what put it over the top was watching his movie and seeing like, oh, this is what he does when left to his own devices. Like, this is who he casts.
And then he told me the moment he was on board, he's a busy guy and we got him at just the right time. Me and Wes were there for one of the videos that we're not even in that's going to come out. A song called It Wasn't Easy to Be Happy For You. And it was very early in the morning. It was raining. It was like terrible Oregon weather, overcast skies. And me and him were just talking. And I said, what was the moment, Kevin, that you really wanted to do this? And he said he was driving. And I think Nick Bell or Wes sent him this album, and I think he was like, a new band's album. Like, I'll listen to it, but you know, sign on for the whole album. It's a lot of things to sign on for. And he said he heard Donna, this first track, and it sort of has this fucked up sounding piano, and he was just like, whoa. He said he was kind of like driving and was just immediately arrested by it, and was like, all right, I'm gonna do it, basically. Like, and that was really cool because I think for me and Wes, this album sonically feels differently. Conceptually, it's a little bit, you know, darker and has a lot of new elements that Lumineers fans and non-fans alike are not used to, I think. So
sure.
It felt different to put this out, and we thought, what better way to do something different than with a guy like Kevin?
And it would have been really hard to do three different, like, directors or something right. like
yeah.
that.
To keep consistency. Yeah. I mean, do you guys feel it's a really interesting, I mean, I know it's a concept record, and then the sort of the way that you're putting out is really cool, and then with the videos and everything, and in three installments, do you feel a pressure nowadays to that you can't just release a record? The records, like, kind of have to have a story around them now.
Maybe. I mean, I think it's more, it's less, to me, I look at it like, I admire actually people who figure out ways to creatively reveal something and then creatively make you, like, I've always really admired Jack White's instincts around, you know, whatever he's doing. Sometimes I barely even get to the record, I just know all about it,
right?
And
that guy pays attention to the details. Yeah, that's for sure.
And I was really impressed by his ability to get me interested in what he was doing, and I thought that's a form of creativity that we've never really leaned on. And then I've listened to, like, I listen to, like, a lot of hip-hop artists talk about how they promote their records, and that's a form of creativity to them. Like, I'm retiring. No, I'm not, you know. It's always this, like, it's almost
if
like
you want to announce your retirement does, you know? On yeah. this podcast yeah. that'd yeah. be good for downloads.
And, and I also started growing, like, a little, I knew we were trying to do something, like, with storytelling all along, like, from album one, now this is our third, but I felt like sometimes if you leave a writer to his own devices, I've seen how writers reward those who actually help them tell their story. It's weird, like, you have to help, you have to meet them halfway. And I realized we were just thinking that they were going to figure it all out without any map to the treasure, you know, like, right. It's like we didn't even leave landmarks on the map. It's just a blank page. You should be able to figure this out. Like, we're so special, our music's so special, because it really meant a lot to us, this right. music, and it felt too sacred to even try to explain or promote. It, like, felt like sacrilegious. And then on this time around, I was like, well, what if we try to explain it to the audience and to people who are potentially going to write about this and whatever else? I think this could be a helpful way to actually do justice to what's in our heads. So it was like more of an approach of, like, hey, I think this is an opportunity to really kind of, like, allow people a little more into what we're thinking about and what we're doing with it. And then from there, it was also, like, not every record feels like, oh, this is a, we're kind of, like, firing on all cylinders. Sometimes you're like, that was cool, this is, like, I like this song. This one really felt just like, wow, I'm really happy I'm a part of this.
Yeah, I
feel
like this is our best work. So to help exaggerate that in a non-traditional way of this kind of non-traditional rollout, we felt like the music was there first and foremost. I don't think we would try to come up with some roundabout, you know, kind of hate the term concept album, but right. if we felt like the music wasn't there, we just maybe say, okay, let's just release it. But we know in our hearts that the music is there in this one. We really feel proud of it, whether other people agree. So
yeah, if you get, I don't know, it's like whipped cream on shit. If you if you really dress it up, but it's not good, it's not
going to
help.
There's a tagline for a marketing campaign.
No, what's right? it like? Yeah, whipped cream on shit.
Yeah. Hey, at what point when you were making this record did you guys, I guess, decide or clue into the fact that it was going to be a concept record?
There would be
a through line story through it.
It was percolating, like, 12 years ago. There was, like, I have this this notebook that I found when I just moved, like you just did, sounds like, and I found this stuff I hadn't seen in years, and it was like three EPs, you know, three stories that make up one record, make up like an LP. So, and I, that was in 2006, seven, something like that. And so I was like, oh, I really like this idea, because I do feel like if there's one thing about this age we're living in, it's that people binge on things and people are easily overwhelmed. So
people binge on things and are overwhelmed and get over things real fast.
Yeah, yeah.
You're really into it.
It's very strange. Blah, blah,
blah, blah, and then, because you have access to it unlimited.
It's bizarre. You could be the biggest thing ever and then burn out on it. I don't know. It's a strange time. But I thought to myself personally, if my favorite band put out an EP that I knew wasn't just the EP, it was going to be a part of something bigger, I would kind of maybe like that more personally than a whole album all at once. That was my personal taste. So I was like, well, can we try that? And, you know, we were told at that point when we finally got a record deal that, like, it's just this industry's not set up and designed to work that way. And so we said, okay, the album one, album two, and it was kind of like put on the back burner. And then this time around, we're like, well, can we try it this time? Like, is there some way to do this that you guys will help
get on board?
We've
sold millions of records. Can we give this thing a shot?
Can we put one to do? Bone? Yeah.
We had 15 songs 12 years ago. This is before album one. But the 15 songs were not like amazing. They were just, the concept was cool on paper. But this was, now was the time to execute this idea. Not an album one, not an album two. Now is the time to
and it won't even matter. Like, once the album's out, that will matter like a lot less. I think more what we want to see live on is, like, you know, here's these characters and here's how I, here's how we thought about the record. Here's how I see this person, you know. But it took, you have to have a little bit of like power in your own situation to like get other people to help get on, help get launch it and get it on, get on board with you. So, yeah, it was percolating for a while. And then we had the, we saw like an opening. We're like, oh, this kind of works, you know, like this could be the right timing for it. Because I think we were joking, like, people watch 3 episodes of Game of Thrones in one sitting, maybe. But you give them like a 35, 40 minute record and they're like, whoa, whoa, dude. Whoa, whoa.
They're like, I'm busy. Give me a couple weeks.
In like a month I'll get to this. Yeah, it's a really weird phenomenon, you know?
It is funny.
And the other part of it that occurred to me was that what's cool about music videos, I for the longest time, I really didn't like them. I just didn't. And maybe it was because what people had to make and call music videos was just kind of like lame. Some of them were. But this time around, it's like, if you look at how people even take in music, it's, YouTube's free, so everyone's going there. It's the number one way that they're gonna like kind of see your music, literally and figuratively. And if you do a really good job with that, you're like kind of helping yourself to telling, like, you're enriching the thing that you're making, you know, by those visuals. Right. You're like, and if you just do something really simple or you're removed from it, that's your choice too. But like, my wife doesn't have a, she has a nanny business, a nanny agency. She doesn't have a storefront, a physical storefront. So her website is like the only thing you see. So she has a really nice website. That's what you do. You know what I mean?
Right,
so
right.
It's the first thing people see. So I think it started to be like, oh, this kind of makes sense to try to do these really well and high level and hire like a movie director to do these, because we don't know what we're doing with this. It's not like we could just take this on and collaborate with him. So it's kind of like, I like that it's also something we can talk about, because talking about what's on your record is so difficult, as you know. Like,
and boring it's you that has to talk about it over and over in every interview you do.
And you're like, you start repeating
yourself.
There's
a funny thing about being a songwriter, musician, whatever. You have to then go, like, you write these songs, you make your record, and then you have to go explain it over and over. What did you mean? What did you mean?
It's a little bit like, why, can you just hear the record? Because I can't
what does it mean to
this?
You?
Yeah.
Well, so how's the record? Okay, so you put the first 3 songs out in May. When are the next 3 songs coming?
I think they're coming in July.
And then when are the next 3 songs after that?
Then the last 3 would fall like on the album release, which is in September.
So then it becomes one whole?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
And the videos would all kind of like coincide with those releases. So everything would be out come September, and then people can do what they want with it.
And when you guys were writing this, like, did you have to make an effort, or did you care one way or another to sort of keep a consistent storyline through it all?
We got derailed a little bit, but like the original question I think you said was like, did you plan on this basically? And the simple answer is definitely not. You know, I think we made a record, and then even the sequencing of it was never changed. It was like, oh, I think these 3 really apply to this person, this character,
right,
these 3, and then these 4 at the end. So it was kind of like not how you would ever draw it up or plan it, but it sort of
I feel like that's why
beautifully worked out,
potentially gonna work. Like, if we tried to do this 2 years ago at the inception or the conception of like, okay, let's write a new album, that would be so annoying like and just really complicated. I think we just wrote something really pure and then figured it out.
Have you guys, have you written, like, sort of songs in the form of characters a lot in the past. Is that something you're comfortable with? Like when you're doing that, and you know, you've got these handful of characters that run through this record. I assume you're drawing from personal experience and family members, not necessarily exactly telling their story.
Yeah.
Have you gotten feedback from people that are like, hey, I know that's about me.
I mean, one of them is called Charlie Boy, and it was like one of the more referential, like obvious. This is, if you were in my family, you knew exactly what I was talking about. Yeah. It was my Uncle Charlie. And then I went on to like explain that at shows because people weren't necessarily picking up on it. And I thought it was an interesting thing to talk about with Trump in office and how my uncle went to war. He heard JFK give this speech and he was so, you know, drawn and moved by his words that he volunteered to go to Vietnam and then died in Vietnam. And I was saying the words of leaders really do matter. So don't forget that when we're all just saying he just said it and he was kidding, or it's not a judgment necessarily. It's just a point to be made. Like, because I want the person who is thinking I support Trump to come to a show and at least have their mind be open a little bit to like another side of things. Just a little bit, creak that door open just a little bit, because the believers are already going to be with you anyway, who agree with you. That's, you're like talking to yourself at that point. Yeah. So that was an example. But I remember there was one song, Submarines, on the first album, that I had this great uncle that claimed he saw a submarine off I think like the some eastern coastline. It was like
what, like a Nazi submarine during World War II?
Yeah, I think it was a Nazi submarine, like a and in the song I say Japanese because it rhymed, but I think it would have been Germany. And everyone's like, "You're crazy." And then he died. And then like intel came out that there were submarines. It could have happened,
right,
conceivably,
right.
And he would have been sort of justified. But it was like, so it was that character. But then I had also heard this story about this guy who was, there was this shark that swam in real life, that swam up like the Raritan River in New Jersey and ate and killed a bunch of kids like along this river. And it inspired the movie Jaws.
Mm.
And this town drunk walked over this walking bridge over this river. It was like a brackish water. So it's kind of half salt water, half fresh water. And he saw these giant fin. And he's like telling the town, I just saw this shark. I know what a shark looks like. There's a shark there. And no one believed him. And so I saw this like weird similarity of like, you're sounding an alarm and no one's believing you. And then, you know, what if you were right the whole time, but for some reason you didn't have the credibility.
Hmm.
And so that, those two things formed that song. It wasn't like one person dominated that. And I think that that's the stuff that really, to me, that's the fuel for like a really good story, is that you have these characters you're drawing upon because the things that happen in real life are so strange that it's impossible to make up.
Yeah.
It's just like, that's why it's believable. You know, when you see a movie and you,
yeah,
a villain is too evil, you're like, that's just not real. Usually villains have this, like good ones have this three-dimensional quality, like the, you know, a villain petting a cat or something.
Right.
You know, it's like, why they do that. Cause it's really,
well, you mentioned Game of Thrones before. That was something that a lot of these shows do really well. They make these totally horrible characters that you still kind of like.
Yeah.
You know
what
I mean? Like, there's something likable about them, even though they're the worst people in the world. You know? Yeah.
Jaime and Cersei, like, I was like, I didn't even mind when they like hooked up at one point. I was like, this is fucking weird.
Yeah.
That's how weird it got. But
yeah, like Breaking Bad. You know any of those guys? People are like killing people, but you're still kind of rooting for them.
Yeah.
You know?
That's true.
There's that three-dimensional quality.
I think that's really hard to do.
Yeah. And in a song, I think what's really the challenge or interesting to do is like, you only have so many syllables and so many lines to squeeze that information in. To tell that story, like, how do you do that really succinctly is something I think I get a really big kick out of, because from Leonard Cohen, like, my dad like always was playing either like Leonard Cohen or even Billy Joel has these like really these characters that you're just kind of like, I feel like I know that guy, you know what I mean?
Right.
Or that I think we've been trying to do. Yeah, so our same buddy who helped us storyboard these videos, I remember on the first album, he one of the songs is called The Big Parade, and he drew a little sketch of every character from the album in this big procession, this big parade, because all our songs, we were trying to have these, like, you know, these characters and these scenes that you felt like you knew. And that's a part of what we were trying to do. Like, not every band is like that. Like, but that was something we were into. So it helps to have these videos to sort of further show that.
So you guys, and you mentioned New Jersey, you guys are from New Jersey. You got together as a band in New York, but you're now based in Denver. Do I have that right?
Kind of. I mean,
can you chart that path for me?
Yeah. We grew up in New Jersey together. Right. Wes was friends
with knew each other growing up.
Yeah, we grew up, we knew each other
through siblings, basically.
Like, a lot of siblings in our town had the same 3 to 4 year age gap. So my older brother at the time was friends with Wesley, and I was friends with Wes's younger brother, Sam. And there was a lot of our friends with the same, like, 2 to 4 year age gap, where you had, like, older brother, younger brother.
And where
brother.
Was this in New Jersey?
Ramsey in Bergen County, which is, like, just a little suburb outside of the city. We were, like, 2 miles from the New York State border, but it was New Jersey. And so we knew of each other. But then, in a roundabout way, Wes actually graduated from college, university in Richmond, came back to Ramsey, wanted to start, like, cover band or just an actual
band.
Starting
a band, yeah.
With this guy, Justin, who I was making at the time, like, rap and hip hop instrumental beats with. I just was like 19. I was trying to learn this program called Nuendo.
Your first forays into being in bands?
No, I was doing a lot, and then were.
Yeah, I was in a bunch of bands, and I actually literally said this out loud and internally. I said, I never want to be in a band with a singer because everything's already been said. I was like arrogant. I was probably 17, 18, 19. I was like, you know, between Bob Dylan and, you know, 2007, whatever that was. I was like, literally everything's been said.
Right. Well, there's some kind of truth to that.
Yeah, yeah. I was like,
that's the challenge.
Like, really weird, like, it has to be a time signature. It has to be complex. It has to be busy. It has to be fast. It's like that classic arrogant, you know, late teenage mindset. And then Justin was like, hey, Wes, let's bring Jer into the fold, being me. And then we started working together. And then I was really intrigued by it. We started writing these songs that I think we really revolved around minimalistic stuff. Like, we had a song called Follow the Leader, and it just was 2 chords, E minor and C major. How much could we get out of that? I didn't even know how to play piano when I met Wes. I remember Wes was showing me this really easy, like, bread and butter 101, like, fundamental thing on the piano that would be so easy now. And I just was, like, so frustrated. I was like, yo, Wes, I can't do
it. It was like a tick, yeah.
Yeah, like, get off my back. And
What's your main instrument? What do you consider your main instrument? I know you play a lot of different things, but
at this point, I'd probably consider a piano, but drums I play live. And then when we write music, we do a lot of everything together. Me and Wes can do almost everything except for violin and bass guitar.
Okay.
And the other thing I thought was, like, really cool, and, it, like, your folks let us use the third floor. It was, like, this...
a little loft attic space,
and we could make as much noise whenever. It was kind of like the opportunity that you're just lucky to have, so we were just always working up there. It would be Christmas Day, we'd be working up there. It didn't matter.
That was actually true. I mean, Thanksgiving, Christmas, Wes would be over like 2 or 3 p.m. We were just maniacs. I mean, literally, we were just,
it was like, we were married to it, you know. And I think I was living at home, so I was like, all right, I gotta get out of here, like, quickly, because I'm staying, because you were still in school. And
that was a perfect storm. I mean, because Wes, you were 24 at the time, 23.
So you're just out of college, is that right?
Yeah, I planned on just, like, coming home, get my stuff, and then leaving. And then we linked up, and I was like, oh, this is, like, really a great thing. Yeah, and I don't want to, like, leave right away. Plus, we have a practice space that's so rare to have access to.
Do you know that Outliers book? It talks about Malcolm Gladwell.
It talks about
extraordinary events and extraordinary people. Bill Gates had, like, a ridiculous amount of time with computers.
Right.
He had access to it that nobody else really had.
Sure.
So we had access, and then Wes had a huge fire under his ass to get out. I mean, you're, like, starting to become the older guy, living with your parents, working as a barista, bartender, especially where we grew up. People were like, how you doing, Wes?
They,
like,
thought I was crazy. My dad got
everything
sick.
Okay? So
I remember my dad got sick, and it's, like, subconsciously I was sort of, like, staying put a little bit, and he lived another, like, three years, but it was one of those things that, like, for some reason we stayed glued together. But I think what was cool was you were really into some other corner of music, and I was into this, like, very singer songwriter thing, and then we both started enjoying genuinely what the other person was doing, and then trying that. So I remember you'd come to me with lyrics, I would come to you with, like, a strange chord
progression,
or strange. I remember we did, like, you know, we were doing 6/4 over 5/4 or something, like, and we would just play really that weird. And drill that until we would link up, like, almost like, you know, it like, it's like at a stoplight when you have those lights and they finally synchronize and they go out of synchronicity again.
Right.
It was kind of like doing things like that was really formative.
I mean, were you thinking of like, we want to do this for,
you know,
we want to get a record deal, we want to go on tour, we want to have hit records, blah, blah, blah.
I don't know if you were, but I was like, I really wanted to play music. Like, I didn't care what capacity necessarily, but I knew I was working those jobs in the goal and effort to like be a professional musician. I wanted to tour. I wanted to know what that felt like to do all that. And I think I remember making binders and researching, well, how do you play at the Mercury Lounge? And I had like research on intel on like every band. And that's how I discovered like this Fleece Brothers band that we really got into. And Simon ended up producing our last two records. So it's this weird kind of like spider web of things. But I think one of the cool things that happened that we were kind of fortunate, we worked with this guy, Joe Bransfort. He knew a lot about recording. He had gone to Berklee School of Music and knew as much as you could know about music, it seemed like, and was so talented at piano and drums. And at one point he's like, we were playing really what we felt was like heady, complicated prog music. And he's like, but if you like G chords, just like play G chords. It doesn't matter. Just like play something you like. And by him saying that, anyone else could have said that, but that he said that really, like, I think resonated with us, because it was like almost like we realized we were trying to impress other people and not do something we really loved. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it turned into a much simpler endeavor, like, oh, let's just do the most with the least. That became a really
important lesson. Like, it kind of goes back to what you were saying a minute ago with, you know, everything's been said and done, and you know, how can you, you know, expand on what Dylan did or whatever, you know. That I feel like I suffered that for so long from having to overcomplicate every idea.
Yeah, well, I think as a parallel, we were trying to draw a really like complicated face or a skyline or something, and then at some point said, let's just try to draw a circle. Let's just try to do a circle as good as possible.
Yeah.
And I think we exhausted all this complex ideas, and then we just got over it in a way that felt, okay, now when you hear track one off of the album one, Flowers in Your Hair, I think that was really the turning point of like, okay, now we've almost come full circle where we've gotten so complicated that we went back to...
It was innocent, you know, I think. Yeah. And it was like a little more... We found beauty in like the economy of it, I guess, is a weird way to say it, but there was less, but it felt like more than what we're doing before. I've listened to friends' music sometimes, and I would never say I knew what was going on through their head, but sometimes I feel like people are driving down the road and it's beautiful and the song's beautiful, and then they just drive it right into a ditch because they're insecure that it's not weird enough,
right?
And therefore, it's not cool.
Oh yeah, it's the obligatory, you know, weird chord thrown in there. It fucks the whole thing.
And I think sometimes,
I see what you're doing. Just don't do that. Yeah. It just needs an E minor, man. You get it.
And sometimes that can be really cool. Don't get me wrong, but sometimes it seems like maybe not done out of love, but done out of fear.
Right.
Like there are people who gravitate towards that, and that's their passion. I mean, and that's awesome.
I think that there's different kinds of music listeners. There's the people that listen to like riffs and grooves, and then there's people that want the sad Beatles melodies or something. Those are like kind of like two different types of people, you know?
Yeah,
no, for sure.
They feel music different, you know?
I know, I mean, and we had this like vision board our producer like would set up for us each record, where you just put whatever you want on there as like a simple, you know, inspiration each day in the studio, and it becomes more and more filled into this collage by the end. And Jared put up this really cool, was it a Snoopy or was it a Charlie Brown one?
Some Peanuts,
yeah. And you could probably like describe it better.
Something like, you know, Lionel, the guy that plays piano?
Yes.
I think Lionel has a name that...
Linus.
I forget, Lucy loves him or hates him, I can't remember. But he's playing the piano and... No, I can't remember. Charlie
Brown.
Or they're
playing a record player maybe, and he says like, she says, that's the saddest song I've ever heard. And he says, I know, play it again. And I feel like that's that's what, in a weird way, I think the catharsis of music is, whenever I'm in like the best mood with my friends and stuff, and we put on a song, it's usually something that is oddly really sad, but that feels really good to feel that or something. I don't know. And like you said, maybe there are people who would... I remember talking to a good friend of mine. His dad was like, I listen to your I listen to your music. It's wrist cutter music, but but you look good playing it or something like that. And like I and he likes totally different kinds of music, right. You know. And but for me, I was like, oh, this is kind of interesting and funny to me that someone could hear the same thing and be so interested in it. It's like looking at abstract art. Some people get really frustrated by it. Some people couldn't get enough of it. Sure. You know.
I think ironically too, if you when you listen to the whole new third album, we actually go back, harking back to some of that more complexity that we felt like now we had a handle on it. It was almost like holding plutonium or something at the time, where you're like, you know, it's special, but if you're not equipped to handle it properly, just don't do it. Just play to your strengths and don't right. try the other stuff. And I feel like this time, in a natural way, it wasn't like, let's weird out.
Let's prog it out.
Just to spite ourselves or to spite our fan base. But it's not that out of the box for Lumineer standards, but there's definitely some stuff. Like, there's a song that comes to mind, Jimmy Sparks, that has a lot of chords in there, a lot of complexity that I don't think we could have written and done a good job and done it well on album one or two. For sure. Whatever reason now.
But funny, we were working on that when you were still in college, so that would be like 2005. We had like the main riff of that song. We have versions of it from 2005. Mm. So it's kind of like stuff kicks around and sits around, and then it was like the right time to dust it off and say,
and I think we have your band evolves and you evolve and then it works.
Yeah.
Like at what point did it go from working on songs together, you know, in your parents' basement or whatever, to, you know, to gigging out and getting a record deal and getting management and all that sort of that, the professional side of it starting to click into place?
I mean, we did a very short tour on the East Coast that was like 4 or 5 cities, and then while we were still on the East Coast. But the main thing was moving to Denver, I think. It was just something about, I was living in New York, Jared was finishing his school, and I had this epiphany of, I'm going to get really, really good at making drinks. Like, I was making coffee in the morning and then drinks, alcoholic drinks at night. And I couldn't find time for music because I was just so busy trying to support the rent. And then I would write these budgets out of like, okay, if I do this, maybe I can work a little less and work on music a little more. And nothing was adding up correctly.
Right.
And I was like, man, I'm just going to be a really good drink maker unless I move somewhere. And then maybe I could be good at music. Like, maybe I would try to improve more, you know, and get good at songwriting and get better. And so I called Jared and it's like, hey, the band basically broke up, got back together, and decided to move to Denver in that like single conversation. It was really weird. We kind of said our goodbyes. I was like, hold on one sec. Just what if we did this? Because Jared was going to stay and work in the studio maybe. And it kind of, we just made this move. And I think moving to Denver, we were no longer with our parents around. Our backs were like way more against the wall. And from Denver, you can't really tour a coast. You have to travel far to get to either coast.
Sure.
So it kind of puts your back up against the wall in that way. So we went on like the first tour we did was West Coast, cross, East Coast, back in like 30 days in a minivan with a little trailer on the back.
And this is before you had a record out?
Yeah, yeah.
Really? So you were booking tours even?
Well, with the help of like friends we had met and our experience on the East Coast, but Stealth, who's in our band, plays piano. He had all these, hey, you want to play San Diego, you can crash with this guy, you can play this house show.
But without the big machine like helping you out, like were there people there, like what, how'd that
sometimes
go?
Sometimes, I mean, sometimes you drive like 14 hours, and I remember one time we set up and I think there was 3 or 4 people,
right?
There was 3 or 4 people in the band at the time, so sometimes we would just have a couple beers and get Thai food. You're like, there's not even people here. We were just sleeping at that person's house.
Sure.
But sometimes the house show was actually better than the quote unquote gig.
Yeah.
Like if you were playing, there was a place called Sophia's Thai Kitchen in Davis, California, I remember. And it was like, you'd get paid in Thai food for dinner. And that was like, whoa, this is crazy. And sometimes there was a cover for people that don't know your band to get in.
No one's going to buy that
cover. So sometimes it's more lucrative to play in some dude's backyard or some woman's house.
And just pass the hat.
Well, yeah. That person's hosting. So they'll invite friends at least. I mean, we kind of began to see through the bullshit of the big city kind of game. Because it looks really good on your website. Like, I'm playing New York and this is the venue I'm playing. And you took a lot of like superficial pride in that, looking at your tour dates all full. And then when you go play that, everyone would be waiting for the next band or talking. But whenever we played a house show, it was like you had everyone there in the palm of your hand for the 45 hour you played. And
was that just you two?
It was usually like four of us, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Was there a time when you guys were like a band with everybody playing was in the band? Or has it always been you two guys is like sort of the core of it?
We've always been the songwriters. That's probably the easiest way to say it. So like we write the songs and we record the songs and then we have people like help us create that live.
Now we
live,
have six
usually.
People in the band on stage.
Okay.
I mean, years ago before the Lumineers name came to... you know, into fruition, it was, we had the name Wesley Jeremiah. That was the band name. So unfortunately, the sound guy thought it was one person, I think, named Wesley Jeremiah. And then we'd show up with three or four people, drums, synthesizers.
Frustrated, yeah.
We don't have enough mics for this voice.
I think the guy would probably be high and was like, it's just one guy. And then like, holy shit, I got like, you know, 20 patch cables and 20 inputs going. So,
but it was, I wish I could have told, and I try to tell like people starting out, A, you can live anywhere as a musician. Like, actors don't have that luxury. But musicians, you can kind of live anywhere because you should be touring if you're, like, starting out. You shouldn't be in one place for very long.
Right.
If you're trying to, like, spread the word. But also, like, house shows are far more valuable when you're starting out because we would play a few times in a row as house shows. And then the next time, if we did play a venue, all those people actually knew our music. And they would pay the money and they would come to the show.
So you found people were coming back next time.
Yeah, because you'd actually like get through to them.
Yeah.
But if those same people were at the club that night and you played the gig, they might even not tune in as much as they did at that house show.
Sure.
So they hadn't really opened their ears up or given you a chance. So it was a way to really like get through to somebody, to their heart, that a lot of those venues, like I remember playing the Bitter End, you know, probably 30 times in New York, and it was always our friends coming out, which was, I thank them endlessly, and they're always, they can come to any show they want now, but it was never like more than that.
Right.
You know, it was like, and the opening band's friends and fans didn't give a shit about our music. And so it was like this weird, it was a weird merry-go-round that there wasn't a whole lot of progress being made. Whereas this was like eye-opening. It was like, oh, this is how you can really organically build something.
Yeah.
Instead of look good on paper, but no progress is being made. You know what I mean?
Yeah. So once you guys did finally get a record deal and made your first record, I mean, obviously that record was a gigantic hit. Was it something that connected immediately, or was it a slow burn?
It was weird. We weren't signed, and that song was put on like this show called Heart of Dixie. It was played at the end of this show, and it was played without any other dialogue over it. It was played in full. So it was a huge...
That was before you had a record.
Yeah.
Well, it was actually funny. I got in kind of like an argument with my ex-girlfriend's dad about that because I think the album came out... Was it 2015? No.
2012.
The album came out in April. So the song debuted in 2011 in December, 4 months before the album came out. Mm. And nobody knew... You couldn't Shazam that song because it didn't exist yet.
Right.
And you couldn't find us really on the internet that well. So the argument was he was kind of like, I think you guys just missed your opportunity. Like, people are going to forget.
Oh, this was like at the time.
Yeah, why is it like...
You guys blew it.
Is the album not out like in December, like when the song dropped? And I was like, it's going to be fine. Like, it's going to be fine. And I remember people were doing like...
in this day and age, it's so hard.
It could have been like...
You know, like, just like Yahoo, take whatever chance you get.
It was Yahoo questions. Like, I remember, oh, we just heard a song that said something like, I belong with you. And I was like...
We didn't have it out. Like... anywhere either. It wasn't like on iTunes or Spotify.
Right.
But we had done a Day Trotter session.
Yeah, yeah.
And we played it pretty close to what the album sounded like. So that became the way people were hearing it. And luckily we had done that session. Otherwise, I think all of this stuff like has a house of cards leaning on itself. But we had management. We had a lawyer in management. That was it for the longest time. And we were really hoping to get on this one label. And we gave them kind of like the right of first refusal. They were like, our dream, I think this is a good home for us. And they were like, nah, I'd rather not. And then we ended up signing with Dual Tone. We didn't know much about them. And then they did a great job. They were kind of like a smaller, more boutique label out of Nashville. But we signed with them after that song was already kind of like on the upswing.
Taken off.
And it was a confusing time because majors were talking to us and we were like, we were just trying to find the fairest deal. So we ended up signing like one record deals for each album, which was really good because it allowed us to have a lot more control over, you know, our situation. And you know how much, I don't think I knew this at the time, but how much like the person you meet at that dinner when you're signing with a label could be gone in a week,
yeah.
6 months.
That is the classic major label tale.
And they were your advocate. They were your fan. And then the next guy comes and goes, I hate the Lumineers.
I'm not
helping them. I don't care about them. So
the road to stardom is littered with those stories. Yeah. That's for sure. Yeah.
So it's freaky. And we had like some good people, especially our lawyer, Richard Grable, was like, tremendously, he was like the North Star and like the dead of the night, where we were, what do we do right now, Richard? And he would say, we're not signing that. We're gonna get you on something where you have like a lot of control and freedom.
Interesting that management and lawyers would be advising you to not sign to the major label. That's I think speaks very well of whoever it is you're working
they
with.
Good, like, normally they'd be like,
take the big check. Come on.
Yeah. Take it now.
This could all end tomorrow.
Well,
I mean, let's talk about that song, Ho Hey, because, and I'm sure you're probably sick of talking about it because that was a few years ago, but I mean, that song was just one of those songs that was like fucking everywhere. Like, you know, like I feel like the sound of that song and the sound of your band is like something that like Madison Avenue clued into, like, okay, we gotta sell this thing, we want to market it as being like smart, let's make it sound like that Lumineer song. You know what I mean? It was one of those songs that gets like so deeply sort of permeated in a popular culture that you hear.
I heard
it's not it, but it's like, you know, if you
there's a Dairy Queen commercial that literally like uses it without using it,
right? Exactly. But there's a lot of commercials like that, you know what I mean? Just you hear that movie, whatever. It's just one of those songs, kind of like in the same way that like that Phoenix record maybe was a few years before that, where all of a sudden you just heard that everywhere. You know what I mean?
Totally.
So, can you describe that experience I've never gone through that. Like, what was that like to have one of those songs? Do you find yourself resenting it, pushing back against it? Does it affect the way you make records moving forward? Like, what did that do to you guys?
I remember other bands being really concerned for us. I remember I remember going on tour. I won't say who it is because I don't know if they would like want me to say this, but they were sort of like, how you guys doing? You all right? Like, and I was like, yeah, everything's fine. They're like, yeah, that song's like everywhere. Kind of like, I think what they were thinking was, people are going to hate it, they're going to hate you, and what are you going to do after this? Because that's all you're going to be known for. And I think I maybe internalized that, but never allowed myself to like think that too much. And then we made a second album, and then still I wasn't going there, but I think there was a lot of pressure to like, I always pictured it like, it was this like, this, I don't know, this upright statue, and you're like in its shadow, and you have to get out from underneath it and get back in the sun. Like, if you don't, you're in the dark, no one's gonna pay it. You have to fight really hard for this fortunate thing that gave you so much to get out of the shadow of it.
Sure.
You know? And
Especially at a time when, you know, bands, and by bands I mean like sort of guitar, bass, drums type of bands, aren't getting through.
Right.
You know what I mean? And so it would have been really, you would have expected from the outside looking in that your band would be a one-hit wonder, that would be the big, and then like the next album nothing would happen, which obviously was not the case. You've made it through the
but our first single slump. Was Ophelia, which was like, no, there was no guitar on it, so I think that also upset the labels, like, you know. But I think of it like it's like a really big blessing, and then you also have to fight really hard to get out of its wake and move on. And like, the closest example that I would always say, I think it's really generous to us because he's an insane actor, but I was using this as a role model, was like, Leonardo DiCaprio was in Titanic, and that was kind of like, that's the Titanic guy. And now when I think of him, he's this just great actor, you know, and he's gotten together with Scorsese and done all these iconic roles. But I think a huge effort on his behalf was made to crawl out from under the shadow of that and just establish himself as something more nuanced than that, like a talented actor. And I think for us, it put us on the map, but not for all the right reasons. And then how do we try to just do our thing, and slowly maybe people will understand what we were about in the first place. But you can't control everybody, you know, or their opinions. But I do think every night when we play it, I genuinely feel like it's sort of, as much as it's our song, it's like a cover song. I feel like I'm in a bar and we're playing it again because some person wrote it, and I'm impersonating that because it was so like an era, and we played it so many thousands of times that it's a little detached, but not in a bad way. And you're sort of grateful for it, but you're also like, man, that was a that was just that got annoying for people, you know, at some point, you know. And I'm not, I think the song's good. I'm proud of the song, but we really like love that record. So it was almost funny to be, if someone was worried about us, we were like, yeah, but when you see a show now, there, when we play that, that's like, that gets a reaction. But like, you know, something like Stubborn Love or Big Parade on the first, on that same album, get way more sort of love during the show. Because I think that one was more of like, that's the child that got all the attention in the, right. the first.
And it doesn't get as much of a, yeah, they're playing the song as it used to. And I think right. we were really conscious of that too. There's a band, another band that I don't want to say, but they had a really big song. And I saw them a few years ago at the Fillmore. It was a really cool venue in Denver. And they played their biggest song. It was like literally the last song of the night.
Right.
And that kind of angered me because I felt like from them, they were like almost operating out of fear. Like, this is the big song. Let's just play it at the end. And I felt like they were, like, I think we felt that we had to do that. And then we said, let's not do that. Let's play Hohei like 3 or 4 songs into the set list.
Right.
And then force you, okay, if that's the song you came here, you're allowed to leave if that's what you want to do. Not being like,
not hold them hostage.
Yeah, like, we're going to play a lot of other songs now. And if you're into that, stick around. We might surprise you. And if you're not, like, you know, there's the door. Not that aggressive, but do you know what I mean?
So yeah,
I think
sure.
we really tried to do that and say, let's get out of this, not whole, but let's, you know, let's break away from being known from the song.
I just got to play it at the beginning of the set, the middle of the set, yeah. the end of the set. Yeah. Just cover all the bases.
To be totally transparent, we did that a couple times, but it wasn't like it wasn't a good idea. But I think also our management at the time was really, I got to give them a lot of credit because they were saying like, you're okay, this is going to go on Top 40 radio because that's where it kind of like wants to go. And we're not going to stand in the way of that, but you guys are visitors on Top 40. Like I don't think that's really where you're going to live or belong as far as like where your music ends up, because that's like it reminds me of Jabba the Hutt or something. It like eats stuff and it just kind of consumes it. Like in an indiscriminate way, it's just like, oh, sure. this is good here. Boom, boom. And there's no, it's just a hard world, I think, to exist in. And we were more like, we wanted to be like, have a deeper catalog and have more songs and be appreciated, not for being popular, but like, oh, this is a cool song. And
right.
I think that zeitgeist thing, as great as it is to be on the wave, you're like ready to get off of it once it's over, because you're like, they didn't really like you for you. They're just fascinated that you got that big, some of those people.
Sure,
when you,
sure.
when you talk to like a DJ on that format, they're like, it's just bizarre. I remember going to Z100. We grew up around there and I was like, I'm on the office of Z100. This is so weird, man. Like, sometimes yeah. cool music makes it onto that format, but it's almost like you're there. You're like there for the day, you know, right.
You're just visiting.
Yeah. We're not supposed to be here that long, you know, whereas some people, they're like kind of more built for that, and they're, so is their music. Like a Bruno Mars, I take nothing away from that, but that's just not what we do. So why would you like expect that from us? You know, we want more to go in these other directions
sure.
that they just wouldn't like. They'd be like, wrist cutter music. You right. know? That's what it'd be like. So,
well, it's when, you know, it's funny because my kids, at the time that was like a current hit on the radio, my kids were a bit younger and in that phase of life where they would, you know, every 6 months or so, they'd have a piano recital. And that, like, not just that song, there were a few of your songs that just every piano, that's how you really know a band's fucking hitting, is when you have gotten into the piano recital world awesome. And you guys were there, man. Wow. It was there.
That's cool.
That's rad.
Anyway, speaking of that, and I just one last question for you. Like, I know you guys are both relatively new dads.
Yeah.
So how has that affected what you do and your sort of how you chart the course for a big tour coming up and all that sort of thing?
It's affected a lot. I mean, I talked to a buddy that has 3 kids. He lives in Connecticut, and he's a guy I grew up with. And he just said before having kids, I literally don't remember what I used to do with my time. And now that he has kids, he realizes he has no time to do anything. And you really know, like, the appreciation of like 60 seconds. Like, yeah. if you have even time to take a shower, you're like, holy shit, I'm taking a shower right now, and I'm not. And you really use your time, I think, a lot wiser, and you appreciate, there's a lot of responsibility. Like, if anything, now you're someone in someone's life for the rest of their lives that, it's intense, you know, it's a huge responsibility, but it's been really amazing. I think there's been so many things that have happened and occurred in my brain that just like were dormant, and then you wake up, like these fatherly instincts or the way you look at a world, the world in general, I think with more compassion, more humanity.
Especially people with small children on planes.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
God, I remember before I had kids, I'd be like, oh, Jesus Christ, now I see a baby crying. I'm like, oh.
Even yeah. like this is kind of a, this is like a depressing thought, but you know, in Denver, you know, you're walking down the street or something, and if you see somebody struggling on the side of the road, like a homeless person or something, you're like, wow, they were a child at some point. What happened? How did this 20 to 60 years.
Somebody's kid or somebody's dad. Or
that's somebody's daughter, that's somebody's son. What the hell happened? And it really like, the first few weeks of being a father, a new father, I was like, wow, this is heavy. This is a new lens, a new scope on life. So
when will your kids get a little older? Because that one of the amazing things that I've noticed with my own children, especially when they're like elementary school age, they just like, kids are born with an incredible sort of innate sense of social justice. You know, yeah. You mentioned the homeless thing. There's like there's
right.
a street. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
That's not right. You know, there's a street where we drive down every morning to go to school, and there's always a couple of homeless people down there, like, you know, asking for change or whatever. And I remember so many times having those like where they would just ask me, like, really just childlike, like,
and where know? Do they sleep?
Right, exactly. Yeah. That kind of stuff that we all just tune out, you know, and kids are just like, they just are tuned into that stuff. It's interesting.
Yeah, I took a transcendental meditation course like in the last 6 months, just to try to like get my shit together on the road and have something meaningful to do during the day, and it's helped a lot. But one of the things they said is that your natural state, if you look at a child, they kind of want to be happy. I mean, they're naturally happy unless something's physically bothering them, or you know, otherwise their fallback state is to smile and to laugh and to be joyful. And as you get to be an adult, it's almost like that's hard to believe. And then when you see them, I see my son, and that's all he generally is, unless, you know, he's teething or something specific you can figure out. And as we get older and you fly on a plane, as you brought up, and everyone's waiting in line and their fallback is to be, how much is this delay? Like, everything is an offense, an affront to their right. well-being. And I'm like, it's really good to remember we started this way. You know what I mean? And we can return to that more often. And also, I think it's so basic and so simple, but I never realized I was getting older until I had a kid, because I saw him getting older. I saw him growing, and I'm like, well, I'm not static. Like, I'm getting older.
Yeah.
But he's getting older, and it's much more easy to see form, you know, growing by the day and getting really chubby and, you know, like all this stuff. And I'm like,
it's crazy when kids are that young.
Yeah.
You leave for 2 weeks and you come back, you're like, whoa.
Yeah, he's just about to walk, and he's just this like Michelin man, you know, he's got like rolls you can like, and I love it. And, but I'm also like, I kind of just thought I was the same person I was 10 years ago, and I'm definitely not. And it makes you just want to, I think be a little more happy when you can, you know, like, and, while we're on the road, I used to look at the road as like, I'm working, and then I get home, and that would be like my sort of time to maybe enjoy, in quotes. And then now I'm like, I gotta get better at, like, that's my life now.
Yeah.
Like, I can't just compartmentalize my happiness just to being on stage or being off the road. It has to be more than that, or else I'm kind of failing. So it definitely like tried to raise the bar for me as far as like where I can be at, because I realized I was kind of making that mistake, you know, without really realizing it until we had kids.
It's funny, you know, the kid thing, like, for me, and you mentioned the road, like, for me now, touring is where I, like, sleep in, go to the gym when I want to, maybe I'll go walk around town, have a coffee, and getting home, I'm an Uber driver, you know, my kids are like in middle school, an high school age, intern, you know what I mean? Yeah, so it's funny, it is completely funny. Well, thank you guys for doing this, man. I'm sure you got 8,000 things you got to get to.
No, and thanks for having us.
Man.
Yeah.
It's great talking
thank
to you.
Thank you, this was great.
Thanks for having us, man, big fan.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, that was Wes and Jeremiah from the Lumineers. You know what to do. Get on over to walkingthefloor.com. As always, I will be putting a bunch of links to cool things that we talked about in this interview, so you can get all your Lumineers info, find out where they're playing, when their releases are hitting the streaming services, watch the videos, do all that stuff, buy a freaking t-shirt.
And, of course, don't forget to get on over to my other website, chrisshiffertmusic.com, and get your tickets today for my upcoming tour dates. It's a solid 2 weeks across the United States of America. It's going to be a hoot and a holler, and I want to see all you crazy listeners out there. So buy a ticket, get in your car, drive hundreds of miles if it's the tour is not coming close to you, and just get on out there. I'll see you soon. This is Chris Shiflett. Back in 2 weeks with another fine edition of Walking the Floor. Adios, amigos!